Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show. Joining us as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm, at AHMalcolm on X.com or Twitter.com if you're an old timer like me. Welcome back, Your Highness.
Yes. Yes. I'm glad you addressed me properly this week.
Of course, yes. It's I have to. I mean, this is your title. I have to. I'm the one who came up with it, so I have to honor the bit. There's a lot of stuff going on in politics and the media. I don't necessarily think we need to get into a big, huge discussion of what's going on in Minnesota, but I do think that it's interesting to see how things have changed in the last 2 days.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much in terms of media coverage, although I think that this is what it's intended to do. But, you know, there was another shooting in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. This was shooting of a guy who was apparently trying to obstruct an arrest, who was carrying a weapon, which is a bad idea if you're going to try to obstruct law enforcement. There was some confusion over the weapon, and he ended up being shot and killed. That's going to be investigated. Those details will eventually all come out. Everybody's wearing body cams and that thing. We haven't seen all the evidence yet. But, you know, the problem that happened, I think, and this is different than the issue with what happened with the first shooting with Renee Good, where the officials who were in charge tried, I think, to stick to what the evidence was showing them. In this case, Christy Noem and Gregory Bovino and some other people at the Homeland Security were saying this guy was a terrorist and this and that and the other thing, and he pulled a weapon and he shot at people, and the video just simply didn't match up with that. And it looked like Noem got over her skis on this and got the White House involved. And then it started going badly for them over the weekend because it was clear that the White House had been misinformed. And so Sunday night, Donald Trump is talking about trying to dial down the tension. And on Monday morning, yesterday morning, he put Tom Homan in charge, reporting only to him, which is normally where you'd have a cabinet secretary. Like, yeah. Oh, Christy Noem, for example. He bypassed Noem, he bypassed Bovino, he put Homan in charge of the whole thing. I'm sorry, we're getting a little slap back here. So if you're listening to this and hearing it, I apologize. I mean, this tells me that Trump wanted to change the conversation. And then Tim Walz calls Trump to say, let's figure out a way to cooperate. And then Jacob Frey calls Trump to do the same thing. So changing the leadership here seems to have brought an opportunity to dial things down considerably. And all of a sudden last night, Minneapolis law enforcement, local law enforcement, starts arresting protesters rather than just standing around and letting them do what they're doing. This, to me, seems like improvement. And I think the media is starting to figure this out, too. But, I mean, this could have kept going in a completely different direction, and it was going badly. Do you think that the White House is looking to reset the whole thing here? Because I'm going to bring up Christy Noem's status here. I know Donald Trump talked about it today, but I'm not convinced that we've heard the last of that.
No, I think you're right. See how I can say this clearly. I think the White House realized they were losing as the protesters intended them to lose. This is a replay of the Vietnam War protests, which I covered a long time ago, in which you get people, I don't know whether, the ones today are being paid. So it's a campaign drawing on experience in the past where protesters who this time are being paid intentionally go out to harass the military or the police or the authorities. If you hear what these protesters, you won't hear it because it's not safe and it doesn't fit the media narrative. But if you hear what they're saying to these soldiers, It's just totally disgusting. They are trying to provoke exactly what they got. Two people shot. And to them, that's a victory. They don't care. Like the communists, they don't care how many people get killed in the assault. They just want to drain the patience and the will of the other side. And so Trump saw they were winning. Now, look at Texas. With the cooperation of local authorities, this isn't happening because the political climate and the environment in Texas does not permit it. Minnesota, it's the only state that voted against Reagan in 1984. It's a liberal place. Well, you live there. You can speak to that. And so it's a great place for them to, for the opposition, Trump opposition, to have these confrontations. It's encouraging for peace that both sides appear at the moment. I don't believe they're sincere, but that both sides appear to be dialing down the temperature. But this is going to happen as it happened in California. Remember the riots out in front where throwing concrete blocks off bridges onto the police. It's the same thing. It's a liberal environment sanctuary, which they can find these people who will go out and protest. And, you know, it's like charging the enemy line, and some people get hurt and the organizers don't care. It's the appearance they got. This wouldn't happen if there wasn't television. And they got the TV coverage they want. And so now you see the poll numbers creeping up in opposition to deporting so many people. This is what they want. And it's destructive. But our side, that is the side of peace and reason, needs to figure out a way to combat this. And that is, I don't know how you do it. You can't do it with an inoculation, but these military are human beings, and they can only take so much.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's unpack a couple things here. First off, you're right about the political environment, but it's not unique to Minnesota. And there was data that was produced, it was yesterday, I believe, or Sunday, that showed that well over 2/3 of the violent encounters with ICE are located in 9 counties in the United States, all of which are either sanctuary state cities or sanctuary cities. And I think I can name them off the top of my head. It was Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Denver, Minneapolis, Chicago, New York City, and I'm leaving one out. I think there's one that I've missed here. I think that's it. But they're all sanctuary cities. These are all cities that not only don't cooperate with immigration enforcement up front, they refuse to provide security, I guess you can say, for federal enforcement operations when immigration is the issue, is what's being enforced. And these are very activist mayors and governors who are in charge in these places. And so if you look at this, I think it's something like 490 times more likely to happen. Violence in an ICE operation is 490 times or 590 times. It was something like that. More likely to happen in those jurisdictions than they were anywhere else. And you have to parse this out a little bit, right? Which is that fact that these are large cities. And so you're probably going to get more illegal immigrants in those areas. They're going to be attracted to the jobs that are in larger cities. However, what you don't see is this type of violence in places like Dallas, Atlanta, Washington, D.C. was not on this list. Nashville, Memphis, Miami, you know, Jacksonville, Tallahassee. You don't see those types of cities on there. You don't even see Phoenix and Tucson in these areas, or for that matter, Albuquerque. And the reason is that some of these are bluer areas, some of these are purple areas, a lot of these are red areas, but not all of them. The reason is that they don't have sanctuary policies. They cooperate with ICE. They work with ICE on detainers when they arrest people who are wanted for immigration violations. They alert ICE. They hand over people who are wanted. It's the jurisdictions that don't and then refuse to cooperate on enforcement when ICE has to come in and enforce that create these situations. And I think this was the interesting part about what happened with the call with Waltz. Waltz called Trump, apparently, not the other way around, and said that he wants to cooperate now on immigration enforcement so that they can avoid these types of situations. And Trump was very gracious, as he usually is. When people try to reach out to him, he says, we had a very good call. He talked about the call with Jacob Fry being a very good call. And then all of a sudden, you're seeing Minnesota law enforcement arresting people gathering in the streets around the ICE hotel, you know, the hotel where presumably ICE agents are being housed overnight. Because those hotels have, the night before, another hotel, it may have been the same hotel, I'm not sure, had been basically assaulted. And there was one police officer out there who really couldn't do anything, who got injured trying to keep it nonviolent. And I'm still not sure what happened with him. But last night they were out in force. They sent, it must have been at least 100 officers out into the street. This is state police as well as local police, and just started arresting everybody that was standing around. And they haven't done that at all. And this is the part that I think that the media doesn't want to report, which is that jurisdictions that cooperate in immigration enforcement don't have these kinds of problems. The difference isn't ICE training. The difference is local cooperation, and in some cases, just local obstruction. And that's what the difference was here. When Minnesota's and Minneapolis's governments started cooperating on this, it dialed everything down, as it should.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We shouldn't have had it in the first place, but people, the whole immigration problem was created by the puppeteers who were running Joe Biden, letting in over 10 million illegal people and doing nothing about it, actually helping to hide them and not tracking them. And so the fuse was set. Now, yeah. I wrote during the Biden administration, I wrote that despite Trump's promises, illegals are not going to be expelled. I mean, we're not going to deport every one of them, or even, I'll bet, even a majority of them. And that's why Trump, when he came into office, has quickly focused on the criminals. That's very hard to defend criminals, whether they're criminals in their home country and they're avoiding arrest there, or criminals when they're here and they've done some awful things. Most Americans, I think, would go along with, yeah, let's get rid of them. But, you know, 10 million, we had something like 11 million illegals before. They've been coming in for decades. And unlike previous generations of immigrants, I grew up after World War II, and we had over a million European, they called them DPs, displaced people. They knew they were not going to go home. They were not sending money home. They were here to become Americans. And I knew many of them. My father hired many of them. They were earnest, hardworking people, some of whom had high skills, and they were working in menial factory jobs and produced children. and two or three generations of really solid Americans, American citizens, people who were happy to be here and not here simply because if they gave birth, their son would be a citizen and then they could telegraph money home.
Yeah, you know, we've always had legal immigration. We're going to have legal immigration. You're always going to have some people sneaking over the border. I mean, it just that's the nature of borders, unfortunately. But what we were having was a massive invasion of lots of people coming across the border, millions each year. And the Biden administration refused to do anything about it. You're going to have to get those people out at some point, or you're going to have to at least identify them and ensure that you're going to do something with them. And when Trump said, I'm going to go after these people, I think a lot of people were saying, well, it's kind of impossible to do. You know, the whole idea of self-deportation is kind of silly. Well, as it turns out, self-deportation is actually a thing. They've actually set up a computer app for this, and they're paying people to leave, which frankly is kind of brilliant. And a lot of people are taking advantage of it because it restores their ability to re-enter the U.S. at some point legally.
It's a great idea.
It's a smart idea. But enforcement was always going to look like this. The reason why it's an issue now is that the government has never tried to enforce immigration law at the scale necessary in order to deal with the issue. And we've had sanctuary cities for, 30 years? But no one has ever challenged sanctuary city, and for that matter, state status until now. And it's going to be in court. And they're going to have to deal with the fact that sanctuary status and sanctuary declarations are unconstitutional. States can't declare themselves immigration, oxen free zones for illegal immigrants because state law doesn't apply. The Supremacy Clause in the Constitution gives the federal government the plenary authority to deal with immigration issues. And it, just to emphasize this, let's go back to September 2012, I believe it was, or maybe it was June 2012. In a Supreme Court decision, the state of Arizona had passed a law that required local officials to flag illegal aliens and demand that DHS do something with them. And the Obama administration took Arizona to court. And the states and the U.S. Supreme Court said Arizona can't pass those laws. It's because immigration, the plenary authority for dealing with immigration issues is with the federal government. They're going to have to do the same thing in reverse for sanctuary cities. But that's really what the issue is. And when you look at the violent encounters that ICE and Border Patrol agents have been facing, it's in these hardcore sanctuary cities. And it's the cities that you'd easily identify. And the media doesn't cover that. And I'm concerned that the impression it leaves is that this violence is actually occurring everywhere where ICE is going. It's not true. It doesn't happen in Texas. It doesn't happen in Alabama. It doesn't happen in Florida. It doesn't even happen in Washington, D.C., because those jurisdictions cooperate with the federal government. Washington, D.C. is kind of a special case, of course, because the federal government has pretty much full authority over the city of Washington, but I mean, it's not happening in other, Phoenix or Tucson or Albuquerque. And those are areas that are governed by Democrats at the moment.
Yep. Yeah. It's sad. You would hope in a properly functioning democracy that the responsible opposition would oppose policies on the basis of legal arguments or congressional laws, resolutions. But they're not. They're doing it. Democrats are doing it now it's kind of obvious to get a whole generation of Democrat voters somehow legalized. And part of the fight is don't have voter ID, don't have citizenship approval. And so it's a mess when you have an irresponsible opposition. As you say, as you properly pointed out, Trump is for a change. There is a government, an administration that is attempting to enforce the law. The reality is we're not going to be able to do it. We're not going to get rid of all these illegal aliens. We can get rid of the worst of them. You know, you talk about cherry picking. It's not really, it's rotten apple picking. We can get rid of the worst of them, hopefully, over time. But there will be these constant attempts funded by people whose motives, I don't, you know, they're very questionable. It's to appear to undermine the United States and its society and its lawfulness. It's sad. That's the what's the word? That's the handicap, one hand behind your back, that democracies are faced with. The communists knew this in Vietnam, and the Taliban knew it in Afghanistan. They don't care how many people die, but if you keep the fight going, the voters will overturn. And if they don't, in 4 years in the U.S., there will be a change. That's what they count on, and that's part of our strength, but it's also a weakness, a serious weakness at the moment.
I want to get to the politics of this, because, I mean, this is, I just had a post that went up right as we were just starting this. You know, we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon. It'll go up tomorrow, Wednesday, which is, how does Trump do a reset on this? Clearly he wants to, right? Clearly he saw things getting out of control, spinning out of control. He wants to preserve the mission, but he's got to do a reset in order to restore confidence in the mission. He's not going to stop enforcing immigration law. And he made that clear to Waltz and Fry. And what he said he told Waltz was, you give us your criminals, that's all we care about. If you do that, we don't have to be there. Which gets to the whole sanctuary city thing going on. And apparently Waltz agreed to that, but we'll see. But here's the problem. John Fetterman today, who's, you know, full of strange new respect from the right over the last year or so, for good reasons too, and even before that, because he's a common sense kind of guy. He's progressive, but he's a common sense guy, and he understands how things work. Well, he came out and said something that I found very interesting, and it had been on my mind as well, which is that he came out and said that Kristi Noem has to go. Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem has to go. He has no confidence in her. Type of thing that people are already saying, Senate Democrats, House Democrats, House Democrats, Hakeem Jeffries is talking about impeaching her. Yeah, whatever. However, he did say something about this. First off, he talked about confidence in her ability to do the job, which I think Trump has an issue with now too. It's the reason why he basically relieved her of command of everything that was going on in Minnesota and gave it to Tom Homan again with the instruction, you report directly to me, you and I are making the decisions there. And this is really the front line of what Kristi Noem is supposed to be doing as Homeland Security Secretary. He also said, don't make the same mistake that Joe Biden made and keep an incompetent Homeland Security Secretary on board just because you don't want to fire her. And this to me is important because Joe Biden never learned the lesson, or at least the Biden regents never learned the lesson that that cabinet secretaries are dispensable. They're disposable. That the whole point of these people is to A, devolve some of the administration off of your own plate onto people who are supposed to know what they're doing, but also is that when things go south politically, you cut them loose and bring in somebody else so that you can say, well, I've dealt with that situation, and get yourself some a fresh start on things. Biden never did that with Mayorkas. He should have done it almost immediately with Mayorkas, and he didn't, because Mayorkas was basically doing what the Biden regents wanted done, which is to open up the borders and, you know, create all sorts of hell for their own purposes. But I think in this particular case, Trump may want to take John Fetterman's advice, because if he wants a reset and he wants to restore confidence in the mission, I think first off, you get Noem out of there, because she clearly mishandled this thing over the weekend and made things worse than it had to be. But also because you've got Tom Holman there, who is a very competent guy who has worked in Democrat administrations. He was Barack Obama's border guy, I think, for at least for a while, and understands how to get things done. He's a person who has some weight in Washington, D.C. And I think that I know Trump doesn't like to retreat and he doesn't like to admit fault and all this kind of stuff. But at some point, the purpose of a cabinet secretary is to cut them loose when things go south, even if it's not their fault, even if it's circumstances, even if they got pushed into it. The idea is if you need a reset, you change personnel. And Trump understood that in the first term. I'm curious as to whether or not you think he's got it in him to apply that. He said no today, but he didn't elaborate. He didn't sound terribly enthusiastic about it either. And I suspect that he might be thinking about Fetterman's advice here.
Yeah, I think he has the chutzpah to do it. I think it's too bad that this. I think it's too bad it happens. I mean, he fired people in his first cabinet. It's a judgment call as to whether they were incompetent or not. Obama, remember the disastrous rollout of Obamacare and the website. He didn't fire what's her name, who was the
Sebelius, right? Was Sebelius in charge at that point? I think so.
Yeah, she was the daughter of the Ohio governor Gilmore, and he didn't fire her until much later, because he didn't have the chutzpah to do it. But things worked out fine for him. To me, I understand the political reality of how things look in a television age, that, oh, well, things will change if you take one guy away. But there's dozens of thousands of people that work in DHS, and getting rid of one at the top, it's just for appearance sake. If she's incompetent, then replace her. But the question then becomes, why did you pick her in the first place?
But that's true. That's true of every cabinet secretary. Yeah, it's true exactly. Of Rex Tillerson. It's true of Rex Tillerson. It was true of James Mattis. It was true of, you know, I liked Mattis, but
Mattis actually quit. He wasn't, well,
Trump. Well, he kind of got pushed out, but yeah.
Well, no, he quit. He quit. His resignation letter was written before Trump fired him. Because he's a man of principle and he's a military man, and he didn't want to abandon our allies in Syria. Trump said he wanted to pull all the U.S. out, and Mattis said, "No, you can't do that. We're tied with them. They've been loyal to us," and he said he was going to do it. So Mattis resigned. To me, that's a principle, and he's got a right to do it. And it's too bad, because Trump could have used him a lot later. Mattis showed that he could eliminate ISIS and the caliphate very effectively, because he's a real soldier. But he has principles. And turned out in the end, Trump didn't withdraw everybody. They're still there. And Trump has been ordering some bombing missions because ISIS has attacked the U.S. troops who are still in Syria. Who Trump was going to leave, pull out, and that's why Mattis quit. So it's an unfortunate mess. And another unfortunate thing is that the media only covers the explosions, the sparklers, the shiny stuff. They don't really explain the underpinnings of what these things are. So, Kristi Noem is fired. Oh, well, that'll change things. No, it won't. But it's the appearance of changing. And I hope Trump is successful in deporting hundreds of thousands, even millions of illegal aliens. The reality is he's not going to get them all out. And we have to learn to live with these people who came here not for the opportunity of America. They came here for the benefits, and some of the benefits they get, they send home. So that's not an investment in America that we have traditionally expected from immigrants. That's my opinion, yeah. And I'm sticking to it.
Well, I'm glad you're sticking to it. Before we wrap up, we should talk a little bit about your Malcolm's memories. This is not a this latest column is not behind the paywall, so go over, check out. Even if you're not a VIP member, and you should be, but even if you're not, Andrew puts up his Malcolm's memories posts, and I know the story of Johnny Carson's toilet paper joke very well. In fact, we were talking a lot about it 6 years ago when the pandemic broke out and there was another huge run on toilet paper, which, you know, turned out that there was a technical problem with the supply. So just really quickly, just so I can get this out, the reason why we ran out of toilet paper for houses is because there's a certain percentage of toilet paper that's produced that's considered commercial grade, which is what goes into public restrooms, right? Remember this, because there's a public restroom joke coming at the end of this podcast. Once everything locked down, nobody was going to public restrooms because all these places were closed. And in some places, no one was using these restrooms for weeks or months. So everybody's at home using the bathroom, and the toilet paper industry ran out of inventory for the residential stuff because, not to tell a very poorly kept secret, the residential stuff is a little nicer of an experience than the commercial grade stuff is. But more importantly, the rolls are larger for the commercial grade stuff, and it won't fit on home, on residential rolls. You know, it's too wide. So it would just jam up. So it took them a few months to retool and to produce enough of the residential stuff to keep up with demand. And that was a real toilet paper shortage, right? At least on the residential side. It was a real shortage. It wasn't that they were lacking the material. It's just that they weren't producing the right kind. But the thing with Johnny was that he kind of created the shortage in a way. So tell us a little bit about that, and then tell us the part about the Oscars. I don't want to give away too much from your column.
Well, there's a little backstory to it. In 1973, Japan had a genuine shortage of toilet paper. There was a short wire service item about it that a congressman in Minnesota, or in Wisconsin, saw, Froelich, Representative Froelich. He represents a district that makes a lot of paper, has a lot of trees. So he seized on that. And he also was getting letters from people suggesting that the Nixon price controls were causing companies to sell pulp paper, you know, little paper chips, to sell them abroad where the price was not regulated to make more money, which makes sense. And Froelich speculated that would cause a toilet paper shortage. Johnny Carson, the wire services, of course, picked it up because toilet paper touches everyone's life intimately, probably once or twice a day. So Johnny Carson made a joke.
If we're lucky.
Johnny Carson made a joke about it. And of course, he exaggerated it and talked about rationing and so on. Well, some people heard that. And they said, well, just to be safe, I'm going to go out and buy some extra. Other people did not hear about it. But when they were in the grocery store, they saw people putting in piles and piles of toilet paper in their shopping carts. And they would ask or didn't ask, but they said, geez, I better get some too. Then, of course, the TV heard about it. Went back to images and appearances again. So they sent crews out to film empty shelves. And one store guy in Seattle, he ordered 20 cartons. He heard about this. He ordered 20 cartons of toilet paper, and the company only gave him 3. So he started rationing, and then that got on national TV, rationing of toilet paper. He didn't need to, but he was being careful. So it created a shortage. There was no shortage. I was at the world's largest toilet paper plant in Philadelphia. Chester was Scott Paper Company, and they were turning out, are you ready, Ed? This is 1974. They were turning out 7,500 miles of toilet paper every day.
Wow.
They were not concerned about a shortage. This is just one factory. They were delighted that sales were brisk. So anyway, Johnny ended up apologizing. And some creative entrepreneurs, as I wrote in them, in my memory post, tried to take advantage of the panic buying by advertising, "Don't worry, there's no shortage of televisions. We have all the televisions that you want to buy." I don't know whether that worked or not, but anyway. And then one day, another memory. One day, I went about this time of year to a factory in Illinois where they make the Oscars, where they made the Oscars. I guess they have a new supplier now, but they made 70 12-pound lead statues, all gilded. And I talked with the people who made it, the woman who made it look silver, the guy who polished out all the imperfections, and they taught me how they make it. And watching, the reality was very few of them went to movies ever. The one guy said, "Oh, geez, the last movie I went to, I think, was the Ten Commandments. That was the best one." They didn't go to the movies, but they did watch TV, and they did complain about the way people hold them by the legs. And he said they're getting their greasy fingerprints all over them. So anyway, so I had some fun with that. And then there was another anecdote this time that I wrote about that about the healthiest American that I have stayed in touch with over all these years, and I wrote about why he was so healthy, how he was so healthy. He was a teenage boy at the time. And so I had a lot of fun with that, as I do with these stories. And often have updates about what happened to some of these people that I write about back then. But I had a lot of fun doing a lot of stories, thousands of them for the New York Times and hundreds for others. And so I decided at the urging of the editor at Red State to write about some of the incidents that were kind of funny and very human.
Yep, and we are delighted. There's a brand new one at redstate.com. Go check that out. And he'll have a VIP thing soon enough too. But I mean, but for right now, go enjoy the free one over there. So do you have any jokes of the week for us?
I do not have any jokes. However, I neglected to mention that there are now 39 memories, and they're all listed at the end of each one. So people can go and see them, and they can look back on their own memories of what they read.
There you go.
But no, I do not have a joke.
Well, I have two for you. Oh. And they're both relatively clean.
Well, that's a change.
Well, that is a change. We'll start with the bathroom joke, though, which is actually clean, but it's a bathroom joke. Okay. I went to the men's room, and I'm sitting in the stall. And I just sat down when I hear this guy's voice in the stall next to me. And he says, "Hi, how are you?" Now, I'm not the kind of guy who likes to start a conversation in the men's restroom, but you know, I didn't know what to say. So I said, "Well, I'm doing just fine." And the guy says, "So what are you up to?" I'm thinking, what question is that? So at this point, I'm thinking this is like pretty bizarre, but I'm going to, you know, so I said, "Well, you know, I'm just traveling. You know, I'm sure just like you." And at this point, I'm thinking I need to finish up and get out of here. And the guy says, "Can I come over?" And I think, okay, now this is really getting strange, right? But I figure I better respond to this. I said, no, I'm a little busy right now. And then the guy clears his throat and says in a quieter voice, "Listen, I have to call you back. There's an idiot in the other stall that keeps answering all my questions." It's clean. It's a bathroom joke, but it's clean. All right. And there was another one here, and I'm trying to remember where it went. I'm on the here it is. I'm on the jokesoftheday.net. I love going over there on days when I'm recording with you, because there's always some fun jokes over there. So teacher asks a question of elementary class, and teacher is doing math. And he says, well, look, here's a problem. I want you to figure this out. Wealthy man dies and leaves $10 million. One-fifth goes to his wife. One-fifth goes to his son. One-sixth goes to his butler. And the rest goes to charity. Now, tell me what each one gets. And everybody in the classroom is looking around at each other. And finally, a hand goes up in the back. And the teacher goes, what's your answer? And the little boy stands up and says, a lawyer. that's probably the best answer you can possibly give to that. But yes, I have no idea.
That's a good one. Okay. All right. I'll buy that one.
Yeah. All right. And all it's clean. It's clean.
It's I clean. Clean. That's jokes. Right. That's
right. Clean jokes. So there you go. All right. Andrew Malcolm, the prince of Twitter, the regent of redstate.com, at AH Malcolm on Twitter. Redstate.com, of course, where you go to find all the things that he's writing. Andrew, we'll talk again next week.
Yes, sir, we will. Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you then, Ed.